Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Terechuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast it over the course of the weekend and also after our noon news on Monday. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and we'd love to welcome him in on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning, and it's good to be with you, reporting in, as usual, as most often at least, from the media capital of the world, New York City, where today we are bracing ourselves rather like you are in northern Connecticut for gusts of winds up to 50 miles an hour. It's not a usual thing here. I don't suppose it's all that usual where you are, too, but the weather is very peculiar these days.
We've had our share of wind this year, and of course, you're not only the media capital of the world, but the opening up media capital of the world in July.
Oh, the summer of New York City is what our mayor is proclaiming it will be. Yes, hoping to open up in June. Now, exactly what opening up means is still a little unclear. And don't forget, of course, this city is constantly beset by the rivalry, though particularly with the two individuals involved, it's especially strong at the moment. The traditional rivalry between the New York City mayor and the New York State governor, it's not entirely up to the mayor himself to declare the city fully open, as many things, including, crucially, of course, the city's transportation system, is under the control of the mayor. So, and with these particular individuals occupying the office, the two offices at the moment, you'll very rarely get them to agree anyway. So it's a bold statement that the mayor has made, but whether the governor comes on board with that same date for opening up is extremely unclear at the moment. The governor, of course, has other problems besides COVID, though you think COVID would be the most important thing in his life, but at the moment he's fighting for his political survival in the face of sexual harassment claims, and also a great doubt cast over what was previously a sort of heroic image almost that he was enjoying for his handling of COVID. Accusations abound and continue and are being investigated that he covered up the truth, the very unhappy truth of deaths among old people's homes, residents. He tried to, allegedly, he tried to keep the fact from the from the population as a whole that these numbers were bad, and he didn't want that fact to interfere with his developing sterling relationship, reputation at the time. So he's got a lot on his plate. But whether or not New York City figures largely in his thinking is not certain, but I would imagine that rivalry, a political rivalry we're talking about, has just not gone away in his mind. He's capable of bearing grudges, as indeed is the city's mayor, even in the face of other much more important things going on.
I wonder how Andrew Yang's going to get along with Cuomo.
Well, Andrew Yang is running for mayor, yeah. but he's not had a very good campaign so far. He had a remarkable impact for an individual with no party backing when he was hoping to get the Democratic nomination for the presidency. But he's bouncing back, attempting to bounce back, after, of course, not winning that nomination, and hoping to figure as the city's next mayor. But his campaign is not exactly going with any great pizzazz at all. He seems to be struggling.
So do we play our call to the post here now for you?
Yes, we do. Let's hear the fanfare. There's there's our fanfare. It goes to not a journalist this time, but a mathematician. I want to apologize for mistaking the mathematics involved in counting our president's first 100 days. I said last week it was going to be happening. The 100th day would be happening on the on the Tuesday of this week. Of course, I got it totally wrong. I was mixing up my Thursdays and Tuesdays. The 100th day was the Thursday, and we now have had President Biden in office for 100 days. So I'm not someone to consult on mathematical matters normally. I'm just not reliable in that area. But I admire mathematicians who crisply and clearly express themselves. And in this case, the very good piece of journalism doesn't come from a journalist, but from an academic in mathematics and economics, called Dr. Zoe McLaren, who is occupying a slot and providing us with a piece of journalism in a slot that has traditionally been called the op-ed until this week. Now, the op-ed dates way back to 1970 with the New York Times creating it. And, of course, although people don't always understand this to be the origin of the phrase, it it means is the position in the newspaper that such a column occupies. It's op-ed in the sense that it's opposite the editorial page. It's come to mean, I think, anything that expresses an opinion, and if people think at all about the op part of it, they assume that it's somehow in opposition to what the newspaper itself in its editorials it believes. But that's not the case. It's just a matter of the geographical placing, which now is sort of so, in a way, so irrelevant to our considerations when we look at journalism now, since the print newspaper is not where most of us anymore see it. We've no idea whether it's opposite a newspaper formal editorial in the printed paper, because we're looking at it online. So the New York Times has stopped calling these pieces of journalism op-eds and is now calling them a guest essay. And Dr. McLaren's guest essay is all about how you calculate the numbers when an epidemic or a pandemic is increasing or declining. And she explains so wonderfully clearly, and this is why I think it's worth fanfaring, explains so clearly how the vaccination program that we've been rolling out can reduce the speed of COVID-19's transmission. And perhaps just as importantly, how vaccination, as it rolls out, can almost have the opposite effect of the spread. It is literally the opposite effect of a pandemic spreading. She demonstrates in ways that I find utterly comprehensible, and that's not always the case when it comes to mathematics. I did give you that warning. The case that we talk about a form of I'm getting lost even in the terms, because they don't come naturally to me. But when you talk about a spread, then you need to know about how to stop a spread, and her mathematical explanation of it is so clear. The end of a pandemic, she says, and this is the paragraph that I will cherish. The end of a pandemic will therefore probably look like this. It'll look like a steep drop in cases, followed by a much longer period of low numbers of cases. Although cases will rise again if people ease up on precautions too soon, and that caveat that she sticks on there is of such great importance, as we're learning so clearly in the practical rolling out of the vaccine and the numbers as they are actually happening in this country anyway. the precautions even have to be maintained. Even that's the mask wearing, of course, and the social distancing and hand washing and all of that must continue, even though the numbers of us who have been vaccinated fully are going up. And that's a real, a really important public service. And to have it explained in ways that I can't do it so well, I refer to you on April 28th in the New York Times guest essay area. You'll find Dr. McLaren's perfect explanation of why this is all the case. And she brings to bear her economics background to health policies, looking in particular at the way specific diseases spread and are contained, such as HIV, tuberculosis, and COVID-19. She makes really, really good expert reading that is very clear to a lay audience, even a lay audience member like me.
All right, so that is our fanfare for today. On to some pretty horrible news, and we'll go to both Israel and India. India first, with their total devastation from this wave of COVID-19. We have a show host here who joins us once a month, Arjun Singh from Jaisalmer. And he's just been talking about it. It's so bad, the hospitals, his mother is battling cancer, and they had to go to her house to administer her treatment because she could not get into the hospital. India is just in an amazing crisis right now.
Yes, reports from India are so terribly disheartening and dispiriting. It's so horribly ironic too, when India has such an astonishing reputation in the world as the world's leading manufacturer of vaccines. It's a particular medical manufacturing market that they have cornered very effectively. But now, they're now in the terrible position of having to import vaccines from overseas. In fact, they're just taking delivery now of the Russian vaccine called Sputnik. And yes, it is horrific. And of course, it all boils down to that same point that the mathematician Dr. McLaren is pointing out, that if you don't have transmission stopped by the physical means of masks and social distancing and hand washing and so on, you are very likely, in fact, proven so, absolutely horribly so, in India, you are very likely to get a continuing transmission. In India's case, much worse transmissioning, overtaking every other effort to get any control on the disease. And the essential reason for that is the sheer populousness of India. The cities of India, as anyone who's been there, are something of a horror show to experience firsthand if you're not used to them. The sense of personal space is almost non-existent in an urban Indian environment. And of course, it's very hard to get any kind of control on a disease that gets as rampant as it has in India. And it's not just India, too. Brazil is now suffering horrific increases, too. Its death numbers overtook in overall total the United States this week, and the similarities of approach in the two countries are sad to say very similar too, helping to reinforce the horrible rampage of the disease. In each case, you have what is called I'm never sure of the value of this term, a populist leader, President Modi in India and Bolsonaro in Brazil, both somewhat slapdash in their approach to controlling the disease. In fact, control is not really what they've been about. Modi has been, right up until very, very recently, been holding massive, massive political rallies. Both of these men, of course, have been remarked upon as modeling themselves to some large degree in ex-President Trump. And in Bolsonaro has been doing the same too. And even as the numbers ramp up of deaths and the spread of the disease in his country, he is urging, he's cheering on those regional and local governments in his country who are opening up and of course making transmission all that more dangerous and in their case contributing to the situation getting worse and worse. But of course the overall worldwide picture at the moment, while America seems to be getting a grip on it all, and we're all many of us at least looking forward to what seems to be light at the end of our terrible tunnel. In India, it's far from that, and there's a great deal of why wouldn't there be a great deal of panic about the matter entirely? Stories coming out of India now are just horrible and horrific. With people running out, with hospitals running out of oxygen, and terrible disputes breaking out about who gets oxygen and who doesn't. It's the most horrific form of a disease taking hold of a country, and the reporting that's coming out of it has been a powerful material to read and very, very distressing, of course.
You know, and it's in relation to that, we'll go to Israel, which last year canceled one of its biggest religious festivals, and this year they decided to hold it, not for 2 days, but for 1 day, but 100,000 people showed up, and then there was what inevitably happens, just that huge crush of humanity on top of one another. A minimum right now, 44 people dead, another 40 injured, and 150 other people in serious condition. Just being called in Israel one of the worst public death disasters outside of war.
Yes, again, it's the very opposite of social distancing, and in this case, it's, the disaster that's been reaped is not of an infectious nature, but that strange phenomenon that happens in very big crowds sometimes, panic, and even sometimes the physical closeness of bodies to each other is fatal in itself. All it took in this case, it appears, is some people slipping on uneven territory. Maybe it was steps, a set of steps, and people falling back on each other and causing what, in a way, you could see as a kind of human avalanche. And yes, it's the worst kind of death being inflicted upon by human beings on other human beings, totally inadvertently, unintentionally, but fatal nonetheless. And it's one of those stories that you just shake your head at and think, how could such a mass of individuals be allowed to gather? But again, people's sense of priorities when it comes to matters like pilgrimages and devotion is often greatly at odds with what many of us would call common sense. But it's happened, and as you say, steps were taken to prevent that, well, to ban that event from taking place at all last year, this year when it has taken place, it's resulted in these terrible deaths. It's an intriguing question as to whether it will happen next year. I suspect not.
Now, I only watched clips of Joe Biden's, President Biden's State of the Union address after 100 days. I turned off media coverage of it because, like I said, I don't need six people around a table telling me what they just heard.
Whoever does, yes. On the other hand, we keep being provided with it again and again and again. It seems to be the formula now.
But it was to me the most historic thing was right off the bat to see two women sitting behind the President of the United States, of course the Speaker of the House and a Vice President now, both women.
Well, absolutely. I mean, to be able to say Madam Speaker and Madam Vice President, as the President standing, addressing joint session of both houses of Congress, is a remarkable thing. And, of course, Biden himself made that very, very clear. And, yes, historic moment. Long overdue. there's no doubt about it. So he plowed on for an hour in the slightly constrained circumstances of a very far from full chamber, with social distancing being observed, of course. But there was still an echo, a kind of faint echo, of what these joint sessions can be when the President speaks to them. And it's a little late than his administration to be doing it, but he used it to mark the very imminent 100th day. Of course, he was speaking on the 99th day. And because of the thinned-out nature of the audience, we were all wondering whether we'd get anything like the echoes of the old roaring of applause, in particular, and the standing up of people who support him, and the resolute sitting down, of course, of those who don't support him. And that still went on. You still got his talk interrupted many times over by at least Democrats applauding. A few Republicans now and again, but the whole thing was somewhat muted in that sort of auditory barometer, if you like, of the President's welcome or unwelcome words to whichever side is expressing that welcome or lack of welcome. And you had a sense of still being a divided house, of course. A house divided, they say, or Lincoln said, never stands. But we've got a divided government, very clearly. And the Democrat hold on the two houses is razor thin in the case of the Senate, not exactly firm in the House. So what you face with Biden at the moment, and all editorial coverage of this is reflective of it now, that Biden may have campaigned on the grounds of being a very bipartisan-minded leader, and that he would govern, he said, with bipartisanship very much to the fore in his approach. But in the actual practicality of it all, he is rolling out an extraordinarily impactful, if it all gets put into place, all the sections of it, a remarkably ambitious agenda. And breaking it down, I suppose, simply as he does oftentimes, into the American jobs plan and the American families plan, as he spent a lot of time saying in this address, he's in practical terms going to be doing this with only one side of the political equation fully engaged. It will be a Democratic agenda being rolled through as firmly as he can, and often, perforce, without Republican support at all. Bipartisanship is not going to be a feature of all the legislation that he wants to get pushed through. So I think commentators are still scratching their heads, really, saying, is this the Joe Biden that we know? But in fact, this is the Joe Biden that we know. He knows how to get things through. His long time in as a member of Congress himself has shown him how to get things through, even when the mathematics don't actually favor him too well. And I suspect we're going to see that from now on. These will be Democrat proposals, widely held. hailed on the Democratic side as every bit as important as anything FDR did in the in tackling the aftermath of the Depression and and during World War II, with a firm government and very much a democratic agenda, and the idea of all of this massive social change being implemented by this president without the support of the other side of the aisle is kind of mind-boggling for those people who still think of Biden as being an apostle of bipartisanship.
And then you had the Republican response by the only black member of the Republican Senate, and that was Tim Scott, came on and did a 15 minutes response to Joe Biden's address.
Yes, indeed, and he pointed out that he's been accused in his political career of being an Uncle Tom. And then we had, of course, the inevitable onslaught on Twitter, where everyone was indeed calling him an Uncle Tom for the positions that he took, firmly declaring, by the way, that America is not a racist country. Quite how you define what a racist country as a whole is not an easy thing to do, but clearly he was taking a set of Republican talking points and then putting his own personal stamp on them as a black person who, as he said, has suffered himself from racism, and it got to the point where his the attack on him on Twitter, his own sort of his own transformation into a target for abuse on Twitter meant that whole topic area had to be shut down. Again, you know, it's an indication of the extremes that we've gotten to in this country, where, you know, civilized debate is often impossible, and it's an indication, I think, of the overheated temperature of the times, and it'll be very interesting to see if such division and partisanship can be the basis on which a major social transformation is achieved, as Biden wants to achieve it. He's going to have to railroad through an awful lot of contentiousness.
Well, you know, sometimes people you can't please people. I have a lot of conservative friends that wrote about his response. And I said, I was glad to see it. And a lot of them came back at me saying, well, are you being sarcastic? And I said, no, just roll any speech given by President Trump before this, and then roll Mr. Scott speaking after this. I much prefer the oratory presence of how he did it. I don't agree with a lot of the things Tim Scott said, but it was not anywhere like seeing Donald Trump respond to anything. So I just think people have got to step back on their heels and just try, and the media as well, instead of being immediately critical, just try to present these people and let it go from there.
That's a hopeful thing to look for, an appeal for coolness in our political, in the temperature of our political debate is very welcome.
David, we'll speak to you next week. Have a great weekend.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Bye now.
That is the Media Beat with David Terechuk here on Robinhood Radio. You can find David on demand, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Terechuk. You can also find him at his own website, themediabeat.us.